My name is Dr. Lucas Murray, and today's guest is someone who needs no introduction here at the Australian Defence College. I'm joined today by Rear Admiral James Liebrand. James joined the Royal Australian Navy directly from school in 1990, beginning his career as an apprenticed aircraft maintainer before being commissioned as an officer in 1993 and joining the Submarine Force. He was subsequently employed as Commander Task Group 627, Director of Submarine Operations, which involved the leading, planning and execution of Australian submarine operations and underwater warfare between 2015 and 2018. For this role, he was awarded the Conspicuous Service Cross. In 2019, he was deployed as the Maritime Task Group Commander for Operation Manitou under the United States 5th Fleet. He holds deep operational and strategic decision-making expertise from his roles as Director General ADF Operations and Plans, that's the J3 at Headquarters JOC, Joint Operations Command, and as Chief of Staff to the Chief of the Defence Force. Now, as Commander of the Australian Defence College, or COM-ADC, as it's more commonly known around here, he leads the professional military education enterprise, responsible for delivering the intellectual edge of defence's future leaders. Rear Admiral Liebrand, welcome to the Lives and Leadership podcast, and thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Lucas.
James, I guess the first question I wanted to ask you was how your leadership style has perhaps changed or evolved from your early days in the Navy to your most recent senior command here at the Australian Defence College.
Thanks, Lucas. I was reflecting on that question before I came in, and you know, it's very difficult to actually look back at what you thought you were like 36 years ago to now, because by osmosis, you think your leadership probably is the same now as it was back then. But I think in practical terms, one of the significant difference I think is somewhat with maturity, an extra ability to reflect on things that you likely, or I have likely, become more balanced and reflective as a leader. You don't actually have to achieve everything all at once to achieve good leadership. And I think having had sort of, you know, some great leaders as mentors, and I know you'll sort of get onto that, that your leadership changes, and I think certainly my leadership changed probably at a point halfway through my submarine career when I was a watch leader, when you really decide that operational or tactical level leadership is not about you leading people. It's about getting the best of people you lead. And in that respect, you know, in a control room on a submarine, you have, you know, 20 minds sitting there at once and actually giving a lot over to them to achieve. And then you assimilate the information that they have before you make a leadership decision. A lot of that comes then to you at a later stage in your career as a captain when you are assimilating all the information, letting people quite often make decisions and then making decisions by veto, essentially. So someone gets on with something and if they're okay, just don't say anything. It's only if it's dangerous, unsafe, or is a bad operational decision that you might step in.
Mm. You talk about submarines and you've had a lot of experience working on subs. What is leading on a sub like? Is it quite different to other environments? And can you maybe illustrate that with an example that you have?
Submarines, even within the Navy, I think is a separate leadership challenge. I use a metaphor on a ship. On a ship, the crew live within the hull of the ship generally. The wardroom is higher above that, above the waterline, or higher up above sort of what was called one deck. And you have to walk to the bridge, have to walk up to the bridge and have to walk up to the CO. On a submarine, you're pretty much all at the same level. So my room, my cabin was 7 steps from the control room of the submarine. So people walked past, or not just mine, but a submarine captain's room every day. So you're in it and with it with people. So as a result, you are directly connected to the operations, the actions, the movements, the life of the submarine, whether you're in the control room or not. And I think that's important for people because in a submarine, you quite literally are in a steel tube with other people. And if things go wrong, you go down, you all go down together.
Mm. Were there any challenges of like with certain people or certain personalities or just even the missions that you were on that made that kind of environment quite challenging?
Yeah, look, I think rule number one in submarines is everyone has to get along because you have no private space. The singular private space on board a submarine is inside the CO's cabin. And you have a curtain basically to shut you off from everybody else, but that's about all the privacy you get. So, you know, there was an ad many years ago that said we want introverted extroverts for submarines. I don't actually know what that means, but what I think we want in submarines is first and foremost the ability of people to get on with everybody else and do their job. Personal conflict is not conducive to a good working environment anywhere, and I've said in this role, within this organisation that, you know, as a submariner, my first thing is that all people should get on. If you can't get on, you don't have to talk to the person about anything else other than the things you need to. But, you know, you can only achieve results where everybody is doing their part without any particular ego to achieve the activity.
That must be hard for some leaders who perhaps lead well but need that kind of distance from the crew or perhaps people they're leading? It sounds like you don't have that luxury.
Look, I think, you know, individuals have their own personality and character traits. Like there are many submarine captains who are gregarious and there are, you know, some who are quite personal, quite private, quite reserved. It doesn't make them a worse submarine captain. It doesn't make a person a worse leader. It's just their style, you know. And in a ship, like in any organisation, but I think particularly on ships and submarines, the crew take on the personality of the leader, and you will see crews do that. I had some particular rules in my sort of command philosophy that I wrote when I became the commanding officer of HMaster Shano. One of those was that anybody can give praise to an external organisation, only I will give censure. Because it was my name, you know, effectively on the top of the tin. So if something went wrong in any external organisation, it had to be me delivering that. And one of the others was all we need to be is efficient, approachable and adaptable. Everything else will flow from that.
That sounds like really good lessons. I'll go back to an earlier question I had and it's about your leadership style, your leadership mentors. I'd love to hear, were there any influential leaders that you had growing up, mentors, and what did they teach you?
Mm. Many, I guess, is the answer. And at the risk of naming some, because you could forget some, I probably will not name too many. But a person I found a great inspiration throughout my life, actually, is a bloke who was a teacher, who was a physical education teacher at my school. His name was Franco Giacomantonio. He was the head of the physical education department at Pimlico State High School as a child, and he was so invested in the children, so invested in getting good outcomes for them. He did like frozen drink drives. He was always there at his own time, his own cost, preparing the grounds, making things good for the people who he led, you know, effectively as the physical education department leader. And I found out later, he volunteered at the convent across the road, used to clean up the convent for them. A great person. So, you know, that is selflessness. And I guess we would say in defence, that is service before self, right? So that's one. My very first divisional officer, Lieutenant Brian Eagles, as he was then, retired as a commander, ex-warrant officer. He was, you know, effectively my first influence in the Navy. And he was a pretty hard guy, and I still see him pretty regularly now. He lives in Canberra, but everyone thought he was pretty stern. But he was and remains interested in the outcomes of all the people who he had as a divisional officer in the Navy at HMAS Narimba in a very formative time of people's career. So people joined between 15 and 18 years of age. One of the guys in my class had turned 15 3 days before. Brian, very hard on people, and he did say at a later stage, it's better to be hard early and easier late. You know, you cannot turn that around, and that is a great leadership lesson. You know, it's better to put the effort in and be hard if you need to be hard early, put all the effort in early to then not coast, but to actually look at what you've set in place early. And I think separate to that point, I mean, being a leader is not like moving into a new home and doing renovations. Because if you don't start your renovations within the first couple of months, you're probably not going to do it right because you live into it. Being a leader needs time to sit and assess what's going on in an organisation and make no change and see how it's running first, only then at some later stage to make the changes that you think need to happen. If I mentioned a leader at the back end of my career, though, who I've taken great inspiration, there's two, and they're both the current CDF and the previous CDF, current Admiral David Johnson and General Angus Campbell. You know, they offer, who I both worked for directly, they offer a calmness in command. I think that's important. And the ability to be calm at all times, be still, not talk unless you have to, I think is a really significant leadership trait. Angus Campbell was very much that in everything from Senate estimates to a large meeting. He would listen more than he spoke. You know, there's the great metaphor, you've got two ears, one mouth, listen double the time you speak. I thought that was a great leadership lesson for me, particularly in senior leadership.
Mm. James, I really liked that answer because I think a lot of people that we've spoken to on the podcast have really framed like good leadership or leadership mentors as this one static thing that it just exists from like any age, any culture, any place. But I like your answer because I think it's so true that different leadership styles are going to work at different stages of your life. And there's a reason for that. You know, you're in a part of the journey of maybe in the Defence Force or maybe just in your own, you know, personal life where, you know, some leadership styles are going to influence you in a particular sort of way. And I think thinking about that over the course of one's, you know, career or their life is a nice way to think of what leadership we need at certain moments of our career. I'd love to ask, was there a most rewarding leadership moment in your own career that you could share with us?
Yeah, look, I have these moments that I call Shawshank Redemption moments. And it's when Andy Dufresne is sitting on the top of the prison in the afternoon, where he's got the crew and Morgan Freeman, and they've done the work on top of the prison roof, resealed it, retarred it, and they're sitting down with a couple of beers at the end of it. And Andy Dufresne looks back, and he's sort of, and he can see what he's done with the group. So, and I reckon that only happens a couple of times in your life where you can really sit back and go, I appreciate what I've done here, but you've actually achieved what you've done with the people you have, right? So it's actually not the doing. It's knowing that you've invested in the organisation and the people to the point that they can do it themselves and you can sit back, you know, with that pleasure.
Mm. Is there a moment that you've had that's been like that for you?
Oh, look, I couldn't put my finger on what that exactly is, but it is absolutely related to some of them to submarines, and particularly as the CO, and you can see, you know, it is directly as a result of your leadership and capacity to make a very complex human and mechanical system work. Without a whole lot of bureaucracy overhead, because once you deploy on a submarine, it's you, right? So I would say, and I do say, you know, command is not about you, but it's a little bit about you. Leadership is all about you. And indeed, the way you offer that leadership up, the way you do things doesn't have to be obvious, but, you know, sitting back and actually seeing a highly complex and highly technical unit like a submarine performing well whilst underway is, you know, very rewarding.
Mm. Are there any kind of practices or attitudes or values that you think are perhaps most important in leadership?
But listen and speak. Listen first, then speak. You have to, you know, maybe that comes through seeing an emergency. In an emergency, the first information is never correct. That is an absolute fact. So if you get a call of fire in the whatever compartment, just wait a few marching paces and there might be an update. It might just be smoke. That slow pause, that slight pause to wait to the second amount of information comes is important. And the second key is just because you get the same information twice doesn't mean it's correct. it could just be the same information repeated through a different channel. So again, waiting a little bit and being circumspect about what something is before you take an action is pretty key.
That's a good skill. A bit off topic, but I used to work for emergency services as a call taker, just in between some jobs I did a year for 000 in Victoria. And I think was fascinating there, the kinds of people who are calling when there are emergencies going on and how susceptible they are to be influenced. Like part of the training is to ask questions that don't go down any particular, because people are so susceptible to, if you say something, they'll say, yes, 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 just bring the police. You know, it's really interesting just how people react in those moments and how, yeah, you've got to be very critical and questioning about what they're saying because they're really reacting emotionally rather than giving you the facts. And emergency services is all about triaging and working out what's a priority one compared to a priority three. And so, yeah, it really resonates with
me. The facts are key, and knowing what the facts are in a particular discussion is really important. And similarly, when you're reporting upwards, only report the facts. Don't necessarily report your interpretation. And that extends, I think, to an operational scenario, particularly for submarines, because of the nature of submarines. You're a surveillance asset. Very good for leadership is be an observer, don't be a participant. Often, particularly in direct situations, direct action situations where something's required, if you are deep in the participation component, you can't be a leader because you don't have the ability to observe from the back end of that and actually make changes. Touching buttons, being deep in an action doesn't help your capacity to be a commander or a leader.
Mm. Is there any example of perhaps a challenge in that regard that you faced? I mean, part of this podcast is to kind of help prepare future leaders for the array of contexts that they might find themselves in. And I think speaking about some of the challenges that we've had and maybe how we've dealt with them is fascinating. Are there ones that resonate with you?
Yeah, I think when considering that as the captain, you're not always in the control room, and as the captain, you shouldn't be in the control room all the time because there are teams there operating six on, six off, who need to find their own leadership style. There are officers who are the watch leaders who need to find how they will manage their own watch and deliver the information to you. As a CO, you quite literally have the most training and the most capacity and understand, you know, what other tools you can use to keep the submarine safe more than anybody. And one of the things that I think you should do as a CO is go into the control room, do something amazing, then get out. Leave it, give it back to the people who are supposed to be running it. Because if the watch leaders called you to the control room, it's not really just to have a general chat, particularly in an emergency. You need to be able to apply all those additional skills which and people are concerned in submarines because you're pretty deep sometimes and you're pretty close to the bottom. You have to do something that only you can do, basically. That being done, finish, ready, hand over, get back to the watch. And I think there's a metaphor there for a leader as well. You don't always have to be involved in it. You need to come in, do the things that only you can do as a commander or a leader, and then leave it to the people who are leading at the appropriate level.
Not micromanage.
Not micromanage. Yeah. No, absolutely not micromanage. And again, there's a part about delegation there. You know, you have to delegate everything you can to the appropriate level, and at the appropriate level, people should be exercising that delegation to 100% of their capacity or of their delegation, sometimes over. And again, if that's you, right, so exercise everything within your delegation to the limit of your capacity, sometimes over, take a kick for it if you've exceeded it, but then move on, basically. And I think one of the great limitations of people is not exercising their delegation to the fullest, lofting up decisions beyond, well, within something they could do to somebody else who's already busy to ask them to make a decision for them. It's an abrogation of responsibility in my mind.
Mm. Do you think that's unique to military experience? I know there is many other industries or work life in which there is that delegate. You know, there is like clear roles, responsibilities, and leaders within those organizations. I'm thinking emergency services now, or in medicine, or another, you know, police. There's many other work contexts in which there is a delegation. But what do you think makes sort of a military leader different perhaps, or are there things that from your experience that you think are unique to the military in terms of leadership?
So I think all those characteristics do exist outside the military as well. People will not make decisions to the limit of the delegation and loft that up to somebody else to make a decision because they don't want to seem to be the person who made a hard decision, who made a bad decision, who made a decision that potentially could be second-guessed. I mean, the role of leaders is to make decisions. Sometimes you get it wrong. You know, the role of decision makers in a combat-like situation is to continually make decisions. If one of those is wrong, if you go left rather than what you did right, it's actually not about turning right. It's about what you're doing after you turn right to then actually try and pick up to achieve the aim, right? But I think one of this is good. I think this is important for all leaders. But if you work for me, I will work for you. That is a key leadership trait, and I think in the military, we have such a hierarchical structure and a Byzantine bureaucratic system that's hard to navigate, that doesn't necessarily exist in all organisations outside, but certainly going the extra mile for the people who work for you is key. And that's one of my approaches. If you work for me, I'll work for you. As in, I will do all I can to get you what you want, to train you as good as I can. So you can succeed in the future.
Mm. Something I've noticed, and maybe just because I'm, you know, outside the military in that regard, is that there is this real sense, you know, we talk about service and you've mentioned it before and about the close-knit of that team and maybe the high stakes of certain missions. A lot of jobs don't have some of those qualities or at least to the level that the military or the ADF demands of a person. And that lends itself to, you know, qualities that you said, yes, they exist in other organizations, but you know, not to the perhaps high degree that we're talking about. And what I've noticed, maybe coming from a university background, is that the level of, because of the level of service and the what we're working to protect, there's, and the stakes involved, it lends to a much more, I don't want to say religious, but there's something, it's like we're doing something greater than ourselves. Mm. And that lends us to sort of lock in, I can't think of another word, into that mission in a way that I haven't experienced in other organizations. Perhaps emergency service is one that's more closest that I see that because of the life and death scenario. Does that resonate at all?
And I think that your last point there is probably key, but, you know, leadership in the military and actions in the military are based on, you know, shared difficult experiences, and you know, shared fatal or near fatal experiences, so people can understand in any particular unit, but certainly a combat or a deployed like unit, like many things in a deployed Air Force, specifically in the Army, but on a ship at sea or a submarine at sea, you're in a deployed unit, you're in it together, so that's key. The second is, as you say, you know, decisions can have significantly adverse outcomes, death, you know, the grounding, the loss of a submarine, the crashing of an aircraft, you know, significant, you know, injuries or death in an Army sort of direct-facing combat unit. And that's where it all comes to the fore, because you need to make decisions as though people's lives do depend on it, because they do.
Great. I'd love to ask actually about the crash of an aircraft and a mission that you were involved in. That was very high profile and international. Just for some context, in 2014, Malaysia's Airlines flight MH370, it disappeared. It was in the news in 2014 and it was, quite widely covered. And it was said to have crashed somewhere in the Indian Ocean at the time. Am I right that as mission commander of Ocean Shield, is that you were in charge of the underwater search for this wreckage of the aircraft? If you could tell us a little bit about what that was like.
It's an interesting story. There was a naval symposium on at the time, the Indian Ocean Naval Symposium, IONS. I was the CO of Ducheno at the time, and we happened to be in dock. And we see in the afternoon the aircraft lost, basically, were missing. And the chief of the Navy, who was Vice Admiral Ray Griggs at the time, we were having an afternoon sort of discussion with the officers who were involved with that activity. And I remember someone saying, or him saying, that we need to find a mission commander for this. kind of went out my other ear at the time. And then later that day, someone said, hey, you're it.
Wow.
And the next morning, I went and saw the chief of the Navy at back of the hotel again. He goes, mission commander. Ready. So, and I guess this is one of the things about being the military. Sometimes you're not prepared to do something, but you have to do it straight away. And you have to figure out pretty rapidly how you're going to do that and what approach you're going to take to it. Luckily, there was the ship Ocean Shield, which we used was, it was and is a military, I think now Border Force contracted ship or vessel. So it was in Western Australia, but how to prepare that vessel for the underwater search equipment became sort of what filled our next couple of weeks. So bringing that together involved really interfacing with the crew. And again, I was the at-sea underwater search commander. There was a whole task force formed, some of it resident at HMO Stirling, some of it resident at Jock, to do the sort of command and control for the rest of the parts of the search, which, you know, both surface, maritime and aircraft. The components that came to do that search were effectively contracted US Navy assets and through a company with a company called Phoenix International. So what arrived was a flyaway kit of both remote, untethered underwater vehicles, some tethered TPLs or towed pinger locators, and other search equipment. Some of that needed significant modifications to the ship to be put over the side, and for effect, the untethered underwater vehicle was the size and shape of a Mark 48 torpedo. It was designed, I think, if I remember correctly, to go to 2,000 or 3,000 meters. Maybe we can talk about this later. Subsequently, it went to over 6,000 meters, and there's some really good on-site engineering that happened there.
Where did that take place? Like
On the ship.
On the ship,
basically,
okay.
Yeah, on the ship. And then I had a small team of Royal Australian Navy people to go with us, including some divers, public affairs person. There was a US Navy liaison, I think two people, if I recall correctly, who were in charge of one of the sort of mobile diving salvage units. And then there was the civilian organisation that was contracted, Phoenix International. And then we had two Australian Transport Safety Bureau people and a person from Boeing who came with us as well as the ship's crew. So all that sort of rapidly being done was very long days to get the ship ready and deploy. And we deployed in a southerly direction first because that was kind of where they thought it went down. We probably only got, you know, 12 hours into that before we turned and headed to the northwest coast and started looking at what became the initial search area for MH370. So, yeah, being able to pivot quickly, I think that is probably one of the key things that I'm talking about. And it wasn't just me pivoting quickly. It was everybody pivoting quickly. And you can see, and this is probably one of those great things that I talked about before, seeing how when the organisation turns its mind to do something, the might and weight of a military can actually achieve a lot in a very short period of time to quite amazing results.
Yeah, when it's so high profile, when people want answers, you mean like they can just...
Yeah, well, not just want answers. When we want to do something, you know, the military, all militaries have a huge planning function and turning all that planning effort on at once and all the equipment, you can achieve a lot quickly. It was very high profile. On Ocean Shield, we had extremely limited communications back to shore, and we had limited bandwidth through the satellite communications to the point where I don't remember how many hundreds of emails I received every day, but it was a lot. And I was awake from about 4 a.m. till sort of nearly midnight most days, and I'd log on and try and answer emails, but it was about 20 minutes to log on to the computer and about 4 minutes to do any action on an email. Open the email, press reply, start typing, press send. It was all slow, and I would have to do kind of, you know, potentially hundreds of those in the morning. And indeed, the focus on what we were saying and what we were doing and what we were reporting, that was near instantly reported back into the media, I think with very little back-end filtering within the defence organisation because the information was so critical. effectively arriving on site as well when we finally got to the position we thought is over to the contractor guys to work out the search plan, which was thorough. And again, we had the toad pinger locator, which was looking for the pings of the black box, commonly known as, from the aircraft, which only exists for a certain period of time. And then also to do a bottom survey with a, you know, a high fidelity a side scan sonar or a bottom scanning sonar of the bottom and looking for particular sort of shapes. Failure is one of those things. So those things didn't work all the time. So seeing, you know, how the contracted organisation could go through failure management, and I would say the underwater vehicle, something went wrong with it about 50% of the time. And it was deep. It would take hours to get to the bottom and hours to come up when something went wrong. How they dealt with that and how they looked through the on-site engineering solutions to get that toad pinger locator from 3,000 or 4,000 metres to 6,000 metres. So let's just say it was four, you know, that's, you know, an extra 2,000 metres, which
so
from a pressure perspective is significant. And what they did to that bit of equipment to go and look at the bottom was fascinating. Of course, ultimately, we spent some months out there looking for that and we came back on May the 5th having not found it. And I guess the counterpoint to this particular week is the Malaysian government has now announced that a search will restart for MH370 shortly through a company called Ocean Infinity.
And will Australia be involved?
I don't know.
Yeah, okay.
I don't know.
Yeah.
But again, actually, that's probably, you know, a good point is that when we do things quite often, the military will be asked to assist in an activity. And you might think of COVID as one of those examples, and Lieutenant General Fruin, who is the COVID czar, for want of a better word, we do those things at the request and in support of another organisation. The ADF doesn't necessarily do that for its own outcomes. We'll do it at the request. So Defence Aid of the Civil Community, another one, we will do it in support of the state or federal emergency management bodies, because we have the equipment, we have the people, and we have the planning to do some of those things. But you know, at all times, those actions are done for somebody else, not necessarily for the ADF. We do get some great training out of it as well. But yeah, that's back to the service. I mean, we are a service, and we are providing a service. Yeah,
yeah. And but the agility to do a range of different services. It's not like you're, you know, searching for underwater, you know, wreckages and then defending. You know, it sounds. It's like such an, like you have to have such an agile force and flexible force to be able to deal with whatever's thrown at you quickly. I've just got one last question,
yeah.
if that's okay.
Sure.
And just because of your role currently as Commander, Australian Defence College, or COM-ADC as it's more commonly spoken around here, I'd just love to ask you a question about the role that education and training plays in producing good and effective leaders within the ADF.
Yeah, look, I mean, ADC is an organisation of about 850 staff. It puts through somewhere between 10 and 12,000 students every year. And we have uniformed defence members, Australian public servants and contractors who are delivering that. In the five major divisions, which span from the War College, warfare training and more operational level training, leadership and ethics through Joint Professional Military Education and the Centre for Defence Leadership and Ethics, the Defence Force Academy, so ab initio trainees, you know, specifically, and then the Defence Education Learning Training Authority, which has functions for the registered training organisation that I'm the CEO of, and also whole of defence functions. So your scope across that spectrum, if I left Delta aside, is to bring people into the military in a joint training institution, an ab initio training institution, effectively straight from school, and mould them to become military officers. And to the point that I made right at the start when I was an apprentice, some and many of the things that set your trajectory, I think, happen in that institution. So the quality of the training delivered to people there is key, how they see their leaders. Both interact and interact is key, and knowing that you're actually embarking upon something that is going to be difficult and consuming potentially for the rest of your life, 36 years sort of next month for me, is it. I went to our war college through the Australian Command and Staff course and Defence Strategic Studies course and the Capability Management College. Some of those are about midterm, and we aren't a tactical level staff college. We don't teach tactics. We don't teach manoeuvre like many other staff courses do. We teach thinking. It's a master's level program, but people are trying to consider what they will be pre a command and or staff position. And we also want them to be good planners. And in the current strategic circumstance, we will need more planners, you know, for potentially heightened conflict. For the strategic studies course, DSSC, people are embarking on a change in their career to now strategic positions. And I would like people to understand on that course where they sit as a lever of national power. In the DIME, we always see it written as capital letters, D-I-M-E, M being military. I think the M is small in DIME until it's not. Then it becomes a capital, a very big capital, and that will always occur late. As I talk about pivoting earlier, you know, you'll have to pivot quickly to a decision. That's not a fault of governments, that it's not a fault of defence leadership. That is because when governments decide to commit forces, they're making critical decisions in the national interest. So they are hard decisions, so they'll always come late. When the M happens, that gets done and it needs to revert back to a small M because the other levers of national power will take place. So I would like the DSSC students, one, to be campaign planners, and we are moving that direction. What does campaign mean? It doesn't just mean a military campaign. As we embark on any national effort, there is a campaigning methodology that will need to be adopted to understand how we get into something, how we go through it, and how we come out the back end. I want all of the graduates of that course to understand that they have a cohort. They understand that your leadership must change at that level to be a collegiate, balanced leader, but you still need to lead. And you're an important part of that end part of your career, which is delivering strategic outcomes. And then again, even despite your potential future rank, that needs to be done with humility. That needs to be done with effectiveness, and it needs to be done in a very balanced way.
Mm. James, that was a lovely answer, and thank you for providing that context of not just the promotion courses, but the ADC broadly and about leadership. I really enjoyed this conversation. Thanks for taking the time to speak with us today.
Great pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Hi everyone, today's episode brings us to the final instalment of Season 1. Across this first season, we've had the privilege of hearing from a diverse group of military and civilian leaders, each offering their own insights into what it means to serve, to lead, and to navigate the complexities of the modern military. Their stories, reflections, and lived experiences have helped us deepen our understanding of leadership within the profession of arms. Thanks for listening, for engaging with these conversations, and for supporting this new ADF podcast as it finds its rhythm and its audience. I'm happy to say that we'll be back in 2026 for Season 2 with new guests, new ideas, and more stories that explore the people and perspectives that shape today's military profession. Until then, from all of us here at The Forge and the Australian Defence College, thanks for joining us, and we look forward to continuing the conversation next year.
This episode of Lives in Leadership is copyright Commonwealth of Australia Department of Defence 2025. It is licensed under a Creative Commons by attribution non-commercial no derivatives 4.0 international license. Additional rights beyond this license can be arranged by contacting d.forge@defence.gov.au. For full license details, visit creativecommons.org.